Blog Talk Radio.
One of the first stunt guys from Hollywood on my show. And he had mentioned to me to follow my bliss, and it's been a while since he's been on my show, and it's very blessed that I get him on my show again. So let me see if this is him. Hold on, ladies and gentlemen. I'm so excited. I don't know if I can push the buttons. I'm drooling right here on myself. Hold on. Hello, Colin.
Hello.
You're on the air. Is this Johnny?
Hello.
Hey. Hi, can
hey,
you
how
hear
are
me?
You? Yeah,
hey,
I can hear you.
Good. Can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you so much, waiting patiently, and thank you for being on my show, John.
Oh, awesome. It's always great to be here.
I love it. I was just like, I was just so excited that you're going to be on my show because you are actually the first stuntman in Hollywood to be on my show before, and ever since then, you've been telling me to follow my bliss, and it's been working.
That's great. That's great. I've been following you, you know, on Facebook and, you know, and on your shows and stuff, and you had Melissa and some of my other friends on. That's great. You know, it's just, you know, it's a cycle thing. You just got to start a momentum, and once you get that momentum going, you know, it gets easier and, you know, you get happier and stuff like that. It's, that's how life works, you know?
Yeah, and it's just like a little domino effect. And I'm like, oh, wow, and this circle has brought me so many great people, and I look forward to things and the future things I'm doing. And just as a little refresher, before we get into everything, updating and stuff, can you tell a little bit people about yourself, you know, how you got into it? I know it's been a while, but so that my new listeners can hear a little bit about you in your own words, can you tell people once again how you started in the business and where you started? From like where you grew up and such?
Okay, I grew up in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area, you know, and I had to learn how to defend myself fairly quickly, you know, because you know, there weren't many Asians where I was growing up. I mean, there was people of different ethnicities and stuff, but, you know, where I grew up was a little, it was the tail end of the Vietnam War, so, you know, I got harassed a lot, so I had to learn how to defend myself, and so what I did was I got into the martial arts. That's how I learned to defend myself, but what happened was after I didn't have to defend myself anymore, I started looking within myself and started, you know, developing myself, my, you know, my confidence, my spirituality, and through the martial arts, I understood my own culture, and, you know, I became proud of it, and, you know, and so that's how I got into it. And then, you know, God, what do I do? I was competing on a national tournament circuit in my early mid-20s, and I tore my groin muscle, so I had to retire. So I had to figure out something else to do with my life. And so what I did there was I went back to college. I became a psychology major, English major, and then I finally settled on art. So I didn't know how to draw, but it was something I always wanted to do. I thought, what the heck, you know? So I did it, and within 2 years, I was transferred over to Parsons School of Design. And fate happened my first night there. I saw Billy Crystal record his live album, and he was doing stand-up, and I was like, oh, my God, I have to do this. So, I mean, it wasn't like I never did it. You know, I've always been making people laugh up to that point. You know, in my martial arts classes, I always make my instructor laugh so I wouldn't have to do extra sit-ups and stuff like that. And I always did it to my art instructor, you know, my art teachers, you know, just because I was bored. I guess it's my ADD or whatever you want to call it. So what happened was I saw it because up to that point I didn't think it was as fulfilling as what I was doing in the art world. And I was like, yeah, you know, it's okay. But you couldn't really express yourself fully. But when I saw him, and then I started remembering back about seeing Richard Pryor in his first live in concert film, I said, oh my God, there's a lot to this, a lot more than what I initially thought, you know. So that's why I got into that. I got in for 14 years. I did it for 14 years. I had 3 national TV appearances. I was at the Comedy Store for over a decade. You know, I got to know a lot of legendary comedians. You know, like I did have some real heart-to-heart tests with Richard Pryor. I knew Jim Carrey. You know, Tommy Davidson is a guy that I knew really well when I was there. And when we were there, I realized that he lived like five blocks away from me in Maryland. You know, and Martin Lawrence was, I knew Martin Lawrence really well. You know, he, actually, when I was in D.C. doing stand-up, he was there with me, you know, and we kind of came up to the rank together, although he was there, you know, before I was, but he, I mean, we were friends back then. So, God, what else? Yeah, there's, I mean, you know, many legendary comedians that I've, you know, learned and experienced things on a, you know, on a personal and you know, professional level. It's just amazing some of the stuff you've learned. It's, you know, any, I think any art discipline, creative discipline, all have a common denominator. And I was very lucky that I applied everything I learned in martial arts into my stand-up, and it helped me move quicker along the ranks because of that. And then, you know, I got burnt out, you know. So that's during that time I was you only work at night, you know, you work an hour a night or whatever, and then you get bored. So when I was doing this, I was also starting to get some film roles. So I got on a Jet Li movie, and I didn't know how to do stunts, but back in that time I was you know, I wanted to learn. So I told them, I go, look, I'll do this movie if you teach me how to do your stunts. And they said, sure. So that's what I did, and that's how I got into it. That's how I got in the stunt industry. That was in 87.
Wow. I was, like, viewing, like, some of your comedy skit, and I couldn't stop laughing. I said, yeah, he's crazy, like, really, really crazy. And I mean that in a respectful way, right? And I'm sitting there watching one. You're, huh?
Well, comedians are crazy. That's we are.
Yeah,
I mean, you know,
you are, because I was, and I mean that in a very respectful way, because I was sitting there and you were talking about your parents, and they said, you know, with some Asian cultures, your parents want you to, like, become, like, you know, like a scientist or a doctor and stuff. And you were sitting there saying, like, something like you didn't know English until you were, like, 6 years old. And then when you were talking about, you know, nowadays, I guess you'd be going to jail, like the parents giving spankings to kid. And I know what you were talking about with when your mother said, go get something from your room, and I'm going to spank you, you know, mom spanked you with something, you couldn't get good grades or something, and you got a Nerf, some Nerf thing you gave to your mother, and she ended up getting the racetrack, that long plastic strip, and I know exactly what that was, and I'm just sitting there pissing myself laughing, John. This is stuff you're saying, because I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know, Hot Wheels track, my mom, yeah, that's actually what happened, because my mom was really short, and I could run around real quick, and she couldn't chase me. So she kind of, you know, she kind of cut the lines off by extending herself. I mean, she got to, I remember one time she got, it was a ritual. You know, it's like parent-teacher conferences and report cards were the times I knew I was going to get my ass spanked, because, you know, yeah, Asian cultures, you always got to do really well in school and all this other stuff. If not, you know, you suffer. That's what happens when you have a tiger mom.
Oh, my gosh. And then you were saying that you're, like, the only Asian kid to copy off the white guys. I'm just, like, rolling, because just the stuff that you were saying. I mean, how long did you do comedy for? How many years?
I did for about 14 years. Yeah, did for 14 years professionally, yeah. Yeah.
And how did you get into it? Did you just go to an open mic night? And how did you get into comedy?
All right, here's what happened. I was in my art class, and my teacher, God bless him, Mr. Forsythe, he passed away last year. I still kept in touch with him, you know, up to the day, you know, up to the time he passed away. He would sit there, and he'd run class, and me in the cafeteria, you know, talking to my friends, and little did I know, each week, you know, these friends would get bigger and bigger, and I'd just be sitting there and telling jokes. And he kind of noticed that. And then one day he was, you know, teaching the class, and I would have something smart ass to reply. And he would kind of say, John, I need to talk to you after class. I was like, okay. So he sits me down and he says, look, you got to do something with that. And I'm like, oh, what are you talking about? And he says, you got to do something with that skill, that gift you have. And I'm like, I don't get it. I don't. He goes, oh, you know, well, you know, you're wasting your energy in my class when you should be doing something with it, you know, on a bigger scale. You know, I don't understand. So he took this newspaper and he showed me this. Was look, you know, have you thought about this? And I looked at the thing and says, you know, the comedy club that had open mic, and I went there. I looked at it. Really? He goes, yeah. You should really consider it, or else I will fail you. It's like, oh no. Oh, okay. All right. I get the message. So you know. So I went a couple of times and I watched and I said, you know, can I do this? And so I just kind of jumped off the deep end the first night. You know, I got up there and, you know, it was god awful. I died like nobody's business on stage. It was embarrassing. Oh man, because back then they didn't have classes like they do now.
Yeah, that's true.
You have people that teach classes, so you can kind of when you get up on stage, you have 5 minutes. You have, you know, you can understand what's going on. Where I didn't have it back then. I mean, it was about maybe a year or so later. I took a few classes and studied, but that was it. You know. The first year, I just sank and, you know, either I sank or swam each night, and I had to figure it out. You know, I'd study comedians. I'd sit and watch how they said things and the economy of words and how they, you know, would set you up. So that's how I would study. I'd, you know, videotape the comedians on The Tonight Show and Letterman every night and just sit there and study them and buy albums and watch videotapes of comedians and watch what they're doing. And as, you know, I applied everything I did in the martial arts. Like, I would study fighters. I study comedians mm-hmm. the same way. What does this guy do? What's his strengths? What's his weaknesses? You know, I didn't think that was funny, but the audience thought it was funny. How did he get people to laugh? You know, just stuff like that. It's the same thing I did in martial arts.
Oh. I guess I have a caller on the air, so I'm going to take a first caller. Let's see who this is, and then I want to catch up after this caller. I want to know about all your recent things that you've been up to, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Hello, caller, you're on the air. Hello, can you hear me? I have you in the queue. Maybe bad connection, John. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. No, I thought I recognized the number from someone that I talked to before on the phone. It looked very familiar, so I think I know who it is, and she should call back in. I don't know if it was a bad signal. I tried to grab her in the queue, but it dropped, so hopefully she'll call back in. It was Melissa. And she went to call in, and I clicked the button. So if she's there, call back in.
Yeah.
So I guess until she calls back in, I don't know. It might have just, maybe it was just a bad connection, but I was like, I know that was her. So if she's listening or anything, call back in. But to get back, so John, what have you been up to? What's all things since Battle B-Boy? That was the last thing that I knew that you were doing. So what have you been doing?
Oh, God. Way too much, which is a blessing. earlier this year, I did a thing called What Happened Next for College Humor. That was a lot of fun. It was, you should look it up. What Happens Next, you know, collegehumor.com. I was a stunt coordinator on it. It was a parody of an Upworthy video. And we had a lot of fun working on that. Melissa was assistant coordinator on that with me, and I had Brian Curtago, Hans Weakling, Shelley, and and another guy named Ian, and it was great. We had it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of work. We had to learn how to these guys. They had to learn how to fight in bear costumes, so in bear masks. I mean, I'm not talking about little, funny little bear masks. I'm talking about real bear heads. They had to put bear heads on, and it was like, oh my god.
Oh my god! How heavy was the costumes? Like,
sorry.
How heavy were they? You said you had to wear a bear, like a big bear, B-E-A-R. Did you say bear?
Yeah, B-E-A-R, yeah. They had to put these bear heads on. It was, I don't want to ruin too much about it, but it was, I already pretty much ruined it by telling you what happened, but we had to change the fight choreography. Because the director wanted a Hong Kong high-flying style of fighting. And I was like going, this is going to be really tough with these guys wearing these bear heads. So we had to adjust accordingly on the day. We had some rehearsal, a couple days beforehand. But it wasn't enough for us to really make the adjustments. So we had to make them during the day. Yeah, on the day. So it took us, we shot the whole short in the day. But it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. I hope to work with them again, College Humor again. They're great people to work for. See what else. I'm jumping back and forth. I did, Melissa was a second unit director on this short called The Jade Trader that I ended up fighting, David Carradine's son, Free Carradine, and we had a bunch of other martial artists on it. So I actually acted on it, and I also fought Free Carradine in one of the fight scenes. So that was fun. I'm working on my second book on fight choreography right now. It's called The Fight Choreographer's Handbook: A Guide for Filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
Melissa and I, we just did a last year we gave a workshop for filmmakers on fight design, and we recorded it, and we're in post right now, and we're going to be selling it soon. So we're actually going to be selling it at Dragon Fest on May 19th here in Burbank. So, and I'll be there.
Oh, wow.
We'll both be there. Yeah. So that's what we're working on. We're working on with John Barge on the poster, and we're for the cover of the DVD. So that's what we're doing right now.
Well,
yeah, and also
I can give promotion. Like, I want to know about this stuff. Like, as I have so many people, and I try to keep up with everything because there's so many cool stuff. And I'm like, man, I miss that. So if you got something. A new film or anything, let me know. Post on my wall.
I will definitely. I just signed to do something, to work on a feature. I can't say anything about it because I signed an NDA. But there's this big feature that I'm on that I'll be acting and doing stunts on that I can't even begin to mention past this point. So we start next month sometime. So that's all I can say about that.
Oh, man. See, you got to tease me. You come on and you're going to tease. Oh, tease with Shelly. You guys might drive me crazy with that stuff.
We sign these contracts and we can't, information like that is crucial to the development of the project, and we can't say much about it, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's okay. I totally understand, but it's like a tease. It's like an appetizer.
Once you come out here and start doing this, you're going to have to do the same thing.
Yeah, I know, and it's like, man, because I can't even like the film that I'm working on a Falcare. I can't even say anything, and I'm sitting here going, oh my god, this is awesome. They're like, nope, can't say anything, Shelly. And I'm like, because you're excited, you're passionate about it, but you can't say it,
creative material is an asset, and you got to protect those assets.
Yeah, And it's I totally get that because it's sometimes people want to take ideas that you're working on, so it's good to keep it hush-hush until it's actually filmed.
Yeah, and even then, you know, with Battle B-Boy, we had to do the same thing. I couldn't tell anybody about it. I could not say anything until we were close to post, close to release. You know, now funny thing is everybody's trying to copy it, which is really funny.
Yeah, it's yeah. I mean, I like sharing things on Facebook. I was like, oh, this is, you know, pretty cool, and I do share that. But as far as like getting ideas, like if I get an idea for a film, who knows if I, when I'll be able to do this? Like even that film, the dishwasher, my short film, and I got the idea from the title from Dragon of Bruce Lee's store, and it says that's exactly where I got my title from that story. And where I get ideas, it's like, I don't think it's wrong saying, well, I got an idea for this. You know, everybody says, and it's like, well, it kind of sounds like it's coming from some other place. So there's nothing wrong with giving a little prop, well, I got the idea from this. So, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, copying and stuff, because there's so much done. And I just think it would be more honorable if you say, well, I got the idea from that. I think it's kind of cool. Do you know what I mean? Instead of saying, well, I did this, but it sounds exactly like this other thing. You know, it's kind of crazy, but maybe because I just think different. I don't know. I don't know if you get what I'm saying.
Well, you know, there's divine inspiration. You know, that's what a lot of people call it. You know, it's you know, you experience certain things, you see certain things, and the universe kind of provides you with ideas that culminate from these experiences and things you see and you know and feel. So it's. Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't say I'm getting a lot of inspirations for like Jackie or other people. Maybe it scares them. Because you know all the crazy stuff we see, like you do stuff and I was like, yeah, that's an awesome idea. And people are like, she's crazy. You know, saying, yeah, I want to do my own stunts. And so I saw so-and-so do this. And they're like, well, you're not exactly like Jackie or Johnny or something like that. It's kind of like, well, I can do it my own way. And it just scares people. And I know you have to be careful, but if it's something you love doing it and you get inspiration for something, you know, what's wrong with that?
Well, that's how it works. That's how it works, you know, and you can't let people say that you're, I mean, you know, you got to be a little crazy to be in this business, to be honest with you, you know, because there's so many people and you're always jockeying to, you know, for these parts and these positions and, you know, you got to be a little bit crazy to do it. And the thing is it's when I say crazy, I'm not talking about insane crazy, you know, getting your straitjacket and put you away. But,
yeah,
you know,
no,
it kind of borderlines it. It borderlines it because, you know, when you think about it, how you know, what's your definition of life, you know? And are you going to live a safe, quiet, meek existence? Or are you really going to, you know, follow your dreams? And that's kind of how you have to kind of define your life. You got to ask yourself, you know, am I going to go the route that everybody else went, or am I going to do something different? And that's what gets you, that's what gets you ahead in this, in any creative business that you're in, you know, or just any business, really. I mean, if you think about it.
Yeah, because you're putting yourself out there, and it's kind of funny, and the way you think about, you know, with social media, right, it has its pros and cons. So I'm sitting there thinking it's like people say to have, like, a normal life, like, but if you really think about it, anybody that has anything to do with any social media, Facebook, Twitter, anything, you're never going to have a normal life because everything's out there, and people are going to find you off the internet. So I think anybody that has anything to do with social media, your life is never going to be normal again. And it's kind of hard to think, if you want to go back to normal and have some privacy, you would have to delete all your social media accounts. And if you're in the entertainment business, whatever aspect, if you're a musician or even an independent person, you got to have some sort of social media page to promote your stuff, especially if you're doing everything by yourself. You have to promote it as much as you can and put it out there. So you're going to be out in the public no matter if you want to or not. The only way is if you don't want to ever be in the entertainment business again, you delete everything, you can go back to a normal life. But as far as if you have social media, you're never going to be normal ever again. That's what I think, you know, because you're out there. I mean, you're out there in social media in the public, and perfectly, the only way you can be normal is delete everything. You know what I mean?
Well, it's a lifestyle. It's an approach to, yeah, it's a business like anything else, to be honest with you. I mean, you look at, you know, it's self-promotion. You're what do you call it, an independent contractor. You're a freelancer. I mean, that's how you have to think about it. You know, you're always looking for a job. You know, you're always looking for a next job. Always, you know, trying to develop relationships so you can, you know, get, you know, more exposure, more jobs. So that's the grind, you know. Every day you're hustling, trying to, you know, establish new contacts and find out, you know, what the next project is or create a project.
Hmm. Yeah, and like speaking of projects, right? What was one of your favorite films to work on? I mean, I know that you had like the one, I think it was Jet Li. Did you work with him once or twice? I mean, how many times have you worked on a set with him?
I only worked with him once. We've bumped into each other several other times. It's funny. Yeah, I worked with him that one time, and then I was writing for Kung Fu Tai Chi magazine, he was at a comic book convention, and I called my editor. My editor had a really hard time getting the publicist to talk to the magazine for an interview. So I told the publicist, I said, is it possible I can get an interview with him because I'm from this magazine? And she goes, well, he's kind of busy. I said, well, I did a movie with him, you know, a long time ago. He goes, all right, let me see what I can do. So we went and interviewed, and he looked at me, oh my God, I remember you. Of course let's talk. Yeah. So that's how I got the interview for when, this is when Lethal Weapon 4 came out.
Didn't you you were supposed to be dead and you ended up opening your eyes on set and you saw how Jet Li went so fast and you're like, wow, you're supposed to play dead. What happened again? I remember you telling me that, and I think that would make Jet Li remember you for the rest of your life, his life.
Yeah, well, we did like 10 fights, and I was, most of the time I was either the first guy to get killed, the big hit, or the exclamation point at the end. So he remembered me by that, with that too, because he was like, put him in there. You know, he'll do it. So that's how I got to know him. You know, it was an honor, to be honest with you. What happened was he did that corkscrew, the twisting barrel roll. And when I first saw it in the movie theater, I thought, you know, they must have done that with a wire, and they sped it up. Nobody can do that. And when I saw him do that, he killed me. You know, I was on the floor. I was like, all right, you know, I'll just keep one eye slightly open and watch him do this, because the next guy was doing that corkscrew. So it was a B twist, actually. It was a B twist. So he did it, and I saw him do it, and he landed beautifully, and I went, my mind just went, that was impossible. And I was like, okay, am I in a movie theater, or am I watching this for real? And I went, my mind just freaked out. That's why I went, oh my God. Yeah, the director had a seizure and says, oh, what's your problem? Blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, okay, all right, sorry. And I explained to him, I said, you know, Jet, I'm sorry. I saw you do this in your movies when you were living in China, and I couldn't believe that you could do this. It was impossible. And he started laughing. He goes, no, it's okay.
I think I would have felt the same way, because you know what it is? I think it's like, I know you're not supposed to, like, bother anybody on set, but it was kind of like, you know, something that you're passionate about. I think Jet understood that. Do you know what I'm saying? It's not like you bother him. It's just a surprise thing. And, you know, you're supposed to be dead or whatever, but I think it's just a normal thing. You know what I mean? And it's like, I think we tend to forget that people with big names or whatever, they're just they're normal people. I mean, we should respect the work, but they're human beings just like us. So I think he kind of understood why he, you know, what happened that day on the set. I get that.
No, he was flattered. He was flattered that I was that happened, you know, because I went up to him and said, "Hey, man, I'm sorry. That was really unprofessional of me." But it was my first time on set, you know, working and doing stunts, and I was like, "I got to see this. I have to see this," because I knew I wasn't gonna get another chance to see it, you know, after we shot it. So it just, you know, yeah, it was a fanboy being a stunt, you know, stuntman. You know, it's just like, well, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, how did you, again, once again, how did you get to interview Jackie Chan? How did you, was it on the phone? I mean, how did you, there was an article that you had an interview with Jackie. Now, was this one-on-one over the phone? I mean, how did you go about with the interview with Jackie?
The producer of The Master was a friend of mine, and here's what originally happened before I got on The Master. I was doing stand-up, and I met these executives at Golden Harvest Studios, and mm-hmm. I told them what I did, and they said, "All right, you know, let's see if this works. What we'd like to do is we'd like to film like a comedy special in Hong Kong where half of your act is in Chinese, half of your act is in English. And we'll sell it to HBO or Showtime or whatever. So what we'll do is, you know, we want you to start, you know, brushing up on your Chinese." So I did. I went to UCLA and started studying again and, you know, practicing. And then what we'll do is we'll send you to Hong Kong for about a month or 2 months just so you can get acclimated with the culture and the society and how things are. Yeah, and then we'll film it. So it just didn't work out. You know, so they said, you know, "We still want to work with you." I said, "Well, you know, that's how I got The Master." So I still kept, mm-hmm. I still kept contact with them. So what happened was I had a friend of mine who was an editor for Kung Fu Tai Chi, and she called me up and said, "I need you to interview Jackie Chan." And at the time I was not a writer. I wasn't writing for a magazine. And I told her, I said, I don't know how to write these things. She says, "Don't worry about it. All I want is for you to turn on a tape recorder and talk to him. You know, just record the whole conversation. Then after that, I'll tell you what to do." I said, "Really?" She goes, "Yeah, it's don't worry about it. You're the best guy for it. You're the only guy I know that's seen every Jackie Chan movie out there." I said, "Okay." So what happened? The schedule didn't end up working because the studio that was, it was actually for SuperCop. They moved up the mm-hmm. release date several months, and the magazine didn't have enough time to coincide with the release. So it didn't happen. A couple months later, I took my martial arts students to a Chinese theater out here in San Gabriel. We saw Project A Part 2, Armor of the Gods. I mean, mm-hmm. It was Operation Condor. It was the one, okay, I know it's kind of screwy with the U.S. re-release titles, but it was the one where he was in a desert in the Middle East and the fight with the airplane and the wind mm-hmm. tunnel. So when you watch that fight scene, you're like, "Oh my God, how the hell did he do that?"
Yeah.
And we're out in the Chinese restaurant eating afterwards. Like, we're like, oh my God, how did he do that? How did he do that?" And I was thinking about it. I go, "Yeah, how did he do that?" And I thought about it, and I said, "You know, I really want to know how he does all this stuff." So called up my editor, that my friend who was the editor, and I said, "What happened if I got you a Jackie Chan interview?" And she said, "Well, if you got it for me by the end of the week, I'll stop presses and put them on the cover." So I said, "Okay,
whoa.
Fine." So what I did was I called up my friend and I said, "What would I have to do for a Jackie Chan interview?" She goes, "Well, who's this for?" I go, "It's for me." She goes, "Oh, all right, he'll call you and let me talk to him." And she calls back 30 minutes later. He goes, he'll call you tomorrow.
So that's how I got it. It's all about your networking.
Oh, man. That must have been awesome.
We talked for about almost 2.5-3 hours. It was, I only was able to publish so much of it, but yeah, it was a really cool conversation. Really, really cool conversation. You told me a lot of things about how he did his stunts, and see, here's the thing about Jackie is that he'll tell you how he does it, but are you able to do it? That's the whole thing. You know, are you able to do that stunt? You know, he can show it to you, but are you able to do it? I mean, a lot of people go out there and copy how he fights, which is not really being creative or self-expressive. You're just copying somebody's style. You know, the whole key is to make it your style. And if you ever watch that DVD called Jackie Chan My Stunts, it's very telling. Because, you know, a lot of people copy my stuff. You know, here's how I do this stuff. Now, are you able to take these principles and make it your own? That's essentially what he's telling you. But people don't believe in themselves enough where they end up just copying the guy. I'm like, guys, you don't get it. It's why would I want to watch this when Jackie's doing it better than you are?
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, yeah, that's the whole thing about, you know, everybody copies. It's like, yeah, you know, just take it two steps further, make it your own. Don't copy exactly what this guy did. For Christ's sake, it's already been done. Why do you want to be known as an imitator?
I get your point, because that's how I would think too. I didn't think about that before. I was like, I want to do what Jackie does. And people says, like, when you have idols and such, is be yourself. Bring it, have them for inspirations, but bring stuff yourself. And I'm getting that more and more, because before, you know, 10 years ago, I was like, yeah. So I'm like, you know, like fanboy, fangirl. But now it's getting more and more into actually doing films. I'm getting exactly what you're saying. Bring what you can, because, you know, we're not going to be like them, because that's their whole life. They were born into that. So it's better to bring what you can, and I think people can appreciate that and can see it on the film, and it'll look better.
Yeah, it's funny, because okay. I meet these new stunt people, and they go, and they, you know, that want to get into the business. I shouldn't say new stunt. There's these people want to get in the business, and they say to me, they go, oh, I can do what Tony Jaa or Jackie Chan or Sam Wong, any of those guys can do. I thought, well, that's nice. And I just kind of walk away, and they get kind of pissed. They go, what's up? I go, well, who cares if you can do what they do? Because if I need somebody to do what they do, I'd hire those actual people. Why would I want to hire you?
Yeah, that's true. And then you want to see what they got, because then it's like everybody will start looking the same. You know, I think you want to stand out.
Exactly. I mean, people don't understand that. They go, oh, I can do that. It's like, yeah, well, so? What can you do that he can't?
Yeah, that's pretty hard to say. You know what? Speaking of stunts and stuff, what was one of the most craziest things you've ever done? Like, what's been the hardest thing that you've done in film for yourself?
Oh, jeez.
Making you think on the spot.
You talking about stunt-wise or what, or
yeah,
just
something
anything?
Something that was the hot... Well, first of all, what was the craziest thing you've ever done in a film?
A fight Jet Li was one. you know, almost getting run over by a car is another in the same movie. I'm trying to think. You know, I think creatively... being creatively challenged is something that a few directors will do to their stunt crew. And one of the things that happened was in Battle B-Boy, you know, where I had to combine dance with fighting. And each day on that set, you're like, oh my God, what am I going to do today? How's this going to work? Because we didn't have time for for a turnaround, where turnaround means you rehearse and then you present it for the camera. So the turnaround time was really short. Sometimes I had to do that on the day. And that was really challenging, really crazy, because you hear these dancers were dancing the night before and they show up on set. They're tired, but, you know, when you get them doing what you're doing, they'll wake up right away. And what they did with me was, it was a collaboration, and they rose to the occasion and beyond. And, yeah, I'm really proud of what I did on that movie, you know, because the director gave me the creative freedom. You know, he didn't squash me. He really gave me the freedom to put the camera where I felt it worked the best. And he also invited me in editing to cut the action, you know, to tell the editor what needed to happen in order to make the action look effective.
Hmm. I mean, so you, this was your story. You wrote the story, right?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. So, my whole point of what I wanted to say is that I think a lot of times in films, when people write their stories, maybe they just are screenwriters and they don't do it, but I guess one of the biggest examples of when people sign over their creative rights, where it was a wonderful, wonderful children's series, which was Airbender. I don't know if you've heard of that. It was off of Nickelodeon. And I think they probably really did have a good storyline. It's just that the person, the guys that created the story, they signed over their creative rights, and then that's where all the confusion with the film, and it would have been a little bit better of a film if they didn't sign their rights over, and it's just if they would have done it again, they wouldn't have signed over their creative rights. And I think that's what happens to films, like things get lost in translation for a vision. And I'm so glad that you were able to have that, like, thinking, I really think about, you know, writing the stuff that I'm doing now. I'm going to make sure that no one takes over my creative rights with doing. And a lot of people don't think about that, but what happens to films sometimes, you go, and there's a great story and a great script, but it doesn't translate in the film. So I think you were able to pull that off where you had a creative vision, and I think you did a really good job.
Well, thanks. The thing is, first off, you're dealing with when it comes to Airbender, you're dealing with animation.
Mm-hmm.
And animation doesn't always transfer over to live action well.
I know what you're saying on that, but I mean the casting, like the characters where the little kid is supposed to be Asian, and they whitewashed the film.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I mean, unfortunately, I think what you're referring to is Yellowface. Unfortunately, that's, you know, this is something that I'm seeing is that, you know, this is a generality, but people tend to stereotype, and the thing is. I think as a lot of people don't want, they go, oh, wait, I just need to know the paragraph of what these people are like. And they kind of, it's just kind of glossed over. And unfortunately, in the film world, it's starting to bite us in the ass.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at how, I think it was The Dark Knight Returns was not able to be released in China because of the depiction of Asian characters, and also correct me if I'm wrong, is the same with Memoirs of a Geisha. You know, I saw it and I was offended for the Japanese culture. I was like going, oh my God, this guy did not do his research. I mean, the dance that Zhang Ziyi had to do for her first client, or what do you want to call it?
Yeah.
I was like, who did this? I didn't know Alvin Ailey existed back in the turn of the century. You know, I was like, what was that about? You know, it's these certain creative freedoms that end up not being
correct or being mm-hmm. respectful to the culture and also, you know, I mean, the thing is, you know, if you're going to do something about another race or culture, you got to do your research. You can't just write
yeah.
about it. Think it's what you know, and then it just is. You gotta respect it, even though they might be the villain, or they might be the a sidekick or the location. If you just kind of I've been to Chinatown a couple times, so I know what it's like in China. You're in for a whole heap of trouble.
Yeah, and you know what I'm trying to do, John, is the thing that I was doing. It's like these are ideas, and I know when it comes down, you have to go through your publicist or manager or something, because it was ideas that I have for you. And once again, you're like learning about your background, and I know you're not really. I was talking to Melissa, right, and I was like saying, you know, I would like love to have John as a terracotta warrior in my film. And it's like I'm getting all these ideas because I'm trying to study, okay, where did you come from? And it's like you have a look of a terracotta warrior. And I really mean that. Like I'm studying like other ideas and learning where I'm thinking the bad guys with the ninja and samurai film, right? I'm trying to study and do homework before I'm even really writing the script and getting stories, because there's great people out there. Like here's an example, Don the Dragon Wilson, right? His mm-hmm. bloodline is Japanese. Now, he's a warrior, right? Been in the Guinness Book of World Records 11 times. The thing that got to me, and I brought it up to his attention, and he likes the idea. Of course, this is going to take me probably over a year to write a solid script. I looked at Don Wilson, and I go, he's Japanese. And I looked at him, I go, why has no one ever casted John as a samurai? I mean, Don as a samurai. And I looked at it. So what I did to show everybody what I see, I took this application, took Don Wilson's head and put it in the samurai costume. He's like, oh my gosh, I like it, Shelley, like getting these ideas and knowing what the fans up and writing, like getting ideas, having you as a terracotta warrior. Douglas Wong, hey, it's like I'm calling my ninja and samurai team. Like Don the Dragon Wilson is on the samurai team, and his son Jonathan Hiroshi Wilson, samurai. Douglas Wong is ninja, and he's like, oh, I'm not really ninja. I go, but you're the older, wiser man. And his son, Travis Wong, is the ninja. And it's like going to find out there was Korean ninjas and like going through the history, and it's like there was an African-American ninja, like learning all this history. I'm going, oh, my God, studying. So this is why it's going to take me a half a long time, because with what you're saying, study your history, because I'm going to try to make a really great film. Turn it into a story, and it's like, I don't have the money yet, but people are like, well, we'll try to help package it and get the money for it, but do the homework. You know, I think it's really important and get that point across. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's just, I mean, yeah, I've had meetings and I've talked to producers and directors where they don't know the difference between Japanese, Chinese, Thai, and it ends up biting them in the butt. You know, because distribution won't, you know, if you're trying to distribute to those territories, they're not going to want to buy it, because they're like, you know, what's your problem? This is all over the place. This is what you think of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah, if there's filmmakers out there, you gotta do your due diligence and write what's right. I mean, it's just like, you know, mistaking an Irish guy for a Scottish guy. they'll get pissed. They'll get pissed. I mean, you know, you gotta see it. You gotta see it, you know, in those type of terms. You know, I mean, if you don't know the difference between Chinese, Japanese, Korean, or any other, Asian culture, you need to know the difference. You need to find the difference. And if you're gonna write about it, because this is gonna cost. Yeah, whatever your project costs. I mean, people are investing the money into this, and for you to not do your due diligence and research and making this respectful, yet
mm-hmm.
you know, creative, you're not. Yeah, you're not being true to the people that are investing behind you to make this project work.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of homework and. And, like, how do people, I mean, when I'm looking at the films, and it's like people, well, they say, well, it's just acting, right? And I'm going, no, you don't get it. I says, because it seems like When I'm in two different groups, because it's like, let's put our cards on the table. I'm white, right? You know, I was born here in America. I'm white from Boston. My background's Italian and Irish. Now, when I'm around people that have nothing to do with Asian culture and blah, 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 and it's like not that they're being racist. They're going, well, it doesn't matter. They don't get the point, and I try to push it against, you know, people that are not getting the point. It doesn't matter. It's all the same. I go, no, it's not. It's like, you know, for a ninja or a samurai, there's different, you know, geographies of where they come from and all the clans and all the groups and the families and the traditions. There's different, there's tiny little details that they'll just never care about. But then when I'm sitting here talking with someone like yourself who is, you know, of Asian, you know, ascent, their heritage, it's kind of like there's a whole different ball game now. You know, it's kind of like I can't talk to certain people about this. It's really kind of stinks for me because I see this beauty in all these different cultures and know it's like there's a difference. Because people say, when people say to me, like, here's an example, like Bruce Lee, Jackie Chan, Jet Li, they're all the same. And I'm going, they look all the same. And I'm like, what? I go, are you kidding me? It's like, how do you not know that they're different?
Yeah, they're all ignorant. Well, you know, it's because they're not, it doesn't strike home to them. And, you know, it's, like I said, all this stuff is starting to nip them in the ass right now because China and all parts of Asia are looking for, you know, material. And the thing is we no longer, for a Western film, we can't rely on domestic box office to make our initial investment back. We have to go all over the world, and especially Asia, to make our money back. And, I mean, at the end of this year, there'll be over 7,000 theaters in China. 7,000 theaters. If you look at this, let's look at this. For a major release in theaters in America right now, a major release, a big release like Titanic, that's 3,500 theaters. That is a major release. Can you imagine twice that in China? Just China alone.
Mm-hmm.
7,000 theaters. At the end of this year, there'll be 7,000 theaters. So, you know, if you're gonna put a white actor in yellow face and you expect to sell it in China, I mean, you're in for a rude awakening. You know, they're going to look at it like, you know, they're not even going to release it. They're going to look at the screener and look at you and laugh and say, thank you, no thank you. And you're going to scratch your head and go, why? I grew up watching, you know, Kung Fu and Charlie Chan movies. And, you know, what's your problem? The problem is, there are white actors portraying Asians, and we don't accept that. We don't accept that type of stereotype. You know, do you sell Stephen Fitchett movies to people in Africa? No, you get your ass kicked.
Yeah.
Do you play the jazz singer in Africa? I mean, come on, people, wake up.
Yeah, and it really is getting a feedback from fans where, you know, it's kind of like I'm seeing the comments from fans, and it's getting more and more, and they're like they're sick and tired of certain things, and I'm listening to the fans. So doing homework, and I'm really, like, studying and as much as I can, and it's like I can actually talk to you about this stuff because, first of all, you've had the experience, and it's not just like you're Asian descent or anything like that. It's you really know what you're talking about. You know, and that's why I like talking to people like you, John, is because you get my ideas and stuff, and you're like, I get chilly. So I can talk to you about it, and that's why I'm glad I have you on my show today. And I actually, I have a caller in queue. Let's see it.
Let me add this one thing here before we start.
Okay, sure,
I did this one movie. I will not tell you the name of the movie. There was a villain that was supposed to be Japanese. The filmmaker did not care. He hired a Thai guy. The guy spoke in Thai, and they dubbed him in Thai, and they said it was Japanese. So guess what? We blew all Asian rights, all Asian distribution to it. I kind of looked, why did you do that for? He goes, nobody's going to care. Yeah. air. So, yeah, it totally screwed the, Asian distribution rights because of that.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
John, if I ever get stupid, I seriously want you to find me and just, like, and tie me up or something. If I ever get stupid like that, seriously, I got so much homework to do.
Hey, here's the thing. If there's any filmmakers listening to this, it's not being, politically correct. It's just being sincere with your intent. It's, if you're going to sell something to somebody, just make sure you're not selling them something that's insulting to them. It's Batman. Yeah, but you made the Chinese army and this character, these characters look like crap. It's hard for people to know what is a stereotype unless it's aimed at them.
Mhm. Yeah.
Because they think, this is the way it is, and all of a sudden, when you point that gun back at them, they go, "Hey, that's not cool." It's like, this is now how I feel. I mean, it's this world is changing rapidly, and we cannot do stereotypes. You can mislead them. Like last night, Melissa and I, we saw Nonstop, the Liam Neeson movie. And they took some of that racial profiling and they turned it up on its end, which was, it's just like, okay, it might be that Muslim guy. That's the guy who's the hijacker or whatever, or the terrorist, da, da, da. And then, it ended up not being, So it would have been really stereotypical if it's the Middle Eastern guy. Yeah, it's him. Yeah, because we don't know them, and they're the enemy. It was nice that they didn't do that. It was somebody else. So.
I got one more thing before I bring the caller on the air, because there's something I talk about, and it's like, for me, it's a different story, but people think I'm whacked out of my mind, and I think I can talk openly to you about this because maybe you get my point of view. There's this one film which is supposed to be a great cinema classic. It's Breakfast at Tiffany's, okay? And I think you know what I'm going to get at. There's this one part. Now, the actor himself is a great actor, and I know this was many decades ago when everybody says, I said, that was actually Breakfast at Tiffany's was one of the most racist films of all time. And people are like, well, this is a classic and stuff. I go, no, you do not get it. And I says, if you think I'm just, talking out of my butthole when I say this, because it is a part in the Dragon of Bruce Lee story where Jason Scott Lee, and this was not acting. This was not acting at all. You saw it in his face. He was in the theater with I forget who played Linda Lee, and she's like saying, this is going to be a wonderful film. They showed that part when Mickey Rooney had the big teeth and the glasses and he was acting Asian, and I was like, and you could see in Jason Scott Lee's face, he was not acting. He was so unhappy, and I'm like, and he was playing Bruce Lee, but that was not acting, and I try to tell people that, and I show that and put it on my Facebook page, but no, nobody responds to it. I think they're afraid to speak out about it, and no one gets my point. Now, am I wrong to say that I think that's one of the most racist scenes, even though it was Mickey Rooney? It seems to me it was one of the most racist scenes out of this classic film. Am I wrong?
No, it is. I mean, here's the thing, it's still being done to this day because, I mean, they did, I think they did How I Met My Mother. They did that. They did that recently. And people are like going, this one guy fired back at me and going, there's other problems going on in this world. Don't you get it? The economy sucks and this and that. And I had to fire back and I said, look, this is about business. We know, like I just said earlier, we no longer can rely on domestic box office to make our money back on our initial investments on our films. We have to rely on foreign audiences to make our money back on the money that we put in to make this movie. And in order to make that money back,
You have to understand who you are selling this material to. And it's not just, you know, American people. It's a world audience. You know, I'm not telling you to water down your material. I'm just telling you to be aware of what you're selling. You know, and the thing is, I mean, it's still done. I mean, you know, look at Remo Williams, The Adventure Continues. Eddie Murphy did it in Norbit. It's still being done, you know, because, the thing with Asian culture, we're taught to assimilate. We're not taught to speak up. So that's an issue. That's a huge issue. You're taught, oh, yeah, well, you know, that's their business. This is mine. I'm, you know, and so the Asian culture is taught to assimilate and not make waves, you know, and I think people are starting to speak up now because Asian Americans dance this balance between both cultures, and sometimes both cultures have, you know, don't mix like oil and water. There's all these pockets of things to do and not to do, and how to approach things, and I think now it's starting, after decades, it's starting to kind of solidify, and people are starting to speak up more without having to, you know, deal with the backlash. I mean, because Asian Americans, there's this huge Asian American market that filmmakers haven't even begun to tap into, that they're not aware of.
Yeah.
So I mean, it is. I mean, to be honest with you, it was race. It is racist. I don't. For that time, it was accepted because we were at war with Korea. We were at war with Japan. You know, all this stuff is like, oh, this is what we think of it as, and then it was a stereotype. It is a stereotype. You know, what that was a stereotype. I cringe every time I see that. You know, I'm like, oh, my God. You know, it's sad. But, you know, that's, you know, we have to be, yeah, I shouldn't say sensitive. I say compassionate towards the differences. And if you look past the differences, you'll see the similarities. And the differences won't be as obvious. So, I mean, you know, it's what we do as artists. I mean, I think what we do as artists, we have to, stand up and do our research. I mean, it's changed.
That's exactly, you know, now I'm getting a hold of you. I know you've been busy and stuff, and it's like, see, I know you know the business part. I'm just a creative artist and done some stunts and stuff. See, you know more business-wise, and it's like, you know, I'd love to have you. I know, like Melissa was saying, I don't think you're too much of talking. You're more of an action guy. That's why I'd like to see you in as a terracotta warrior, because I think you would bring honor. And it's like saying, you know, how I want to do that and doing my homework. I would like to submit my film, Funeral War, to, you know, I know it's going to take probably a year or so even just to get things rolling and, you know, money to make the film and everything, but everybody on board where I'm doing my homework, I would love to submit it to different, you know, Asian countries, because it's out of respect. I'm a very respectful person, and having people on board like yourself, if you're able to work with me, I think you'd be smart enough to help me. I think you got that, you know, that business-wise, because I don't know anything about business. You know, having you on board, if you can, you know, work with me, I would love it. You know, and I know you have to go through, I know this is all this business stuff you have to go through, I don't know, publicists or managers for all the right connections, but I'm really meaning it in an honorable way. Why I want to bring you on board is to bring more honor, because that's what I'm about, and that's why I'm writing the ideas for the people that I'm writing, like with Donna Dragon Wilson. I think, you know, all those things, I just want to bring honor. Do you know what I mean? That's what I want to do in this film. I really do, and I mean that.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks. I appreciate it. Here's the thing. I've talked to some filmmakers and writers that try to do their research. You can't always pick up a book, and especially when it comes to Asian history, you can't always just pick up one or two books and get your history. You gotta kind of go there. has and experienced it yourself, or talk to somebody who is from that region or area that you want to write about. Because a lot of times I've noticed this: if you're doing research and you just pick up a couple books and base it off of that, it's going to be very shallow. It's going to, because a lot of times I've noticed that the writer that was writing the book was only able to squeeze in so much into the book, because I'm writing my second book now. There's a certain page count. You can only get so much information in. You can't put everything you learned into that. So you gotta, and also over the decades, there's a lot of mistrust and miscommunication between the cultures. You know, if you look at it, how many times we've been in war in Asia? There's a lot. And also the language barrier, and also the culture, the way you approach somebody is different. You know, a lot of Asians think Westerners are very arrogant or braggadocious about their attitude when they don't understand that. Until they go there, they see, there's a certain way you have to approach somebody or talk to somebody, and they don't see that. They go, hey, just walk on. Hey, how's it going? They see that as kind of being rude or breaking protocol, of how everybody else does it. So they're kind of put off. So that's how it kind of is over there, and it's just a different way of, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. It's just a different way of talking to people. And if you go over there and you meet and talk to people, they'll tell you a different part of history that you might not read in the books.
The films, if you watch films from the countries, right, like during World War II and such, and I forget the name of this film, and I think it was Japanese. I have to think about it. And it was on the other side. It was made from that country. And they were, hiding, during that time, and they, if they get caught, they would kill themselves. And this one guy, I can't even remember, I'll have to look it up, and I'll send you the message, but he was like, he didn't want to kill himself, and it was all about honor. And he was like a young Japanese guy, and I think it was Japanese, I think it was, and he was like, they were like hiding in a cave. And I was like, oh my God. And it's just freaking about it, if stuff was freaking me out. I'm going, imagine it's like, if you're trying to look into another country in their films and see their point of view, what they went through. It's like, it's tear-jerking. With war, no one wanted to fight. In the wars, other countries, they really don't want to fight. I think it's the governments, because it's like extending my hand out even further. I don't know if you heard of this singer. His name is Sungmin Choi. I posted so much on my Facebook. Well, I know I overpost, but he's actually from Korea. And he was very, very poor. He won second place in Korea's Got Talent. But he's trying to come back to America for his dream and to sing. And he, on YouTube himself, right, he has over 100 million views. And this kid is not signed, and he's talented. So I'm sitting there. Whenever I post, this is another thing. I says, if it's going to make people hate me or whatever, because I'm an American, and I mention anything about Korea, people get mad. And I'm like, this is a boy that ran away from an orphanage at age 5 and slept on the streets. He has nothing to do with war, and he wants to think about happiness, and I've made contact with him, and he's starting to learn English. And I told him to stay in contact with me. I'd like to have him on my show. But as an American, I post anything about Korea and Sungmin Choi, once again, I'm trying to show he's a beautiful human being, he's hardworking like anybody else. Nothing to do political. And I post about that. Mentioned about Korea, where he's from, no one cares. And I'm like, or they don't want to talk to me anymore. And I feel like crap, because here I am seeing a person that's beautiful and no one cares. And I almost feel like crying. I'm like, can't people just look like how I'm looking to see? He's still struggling. He won second place, and he's still trying to make it. He was homeless. He sold energy drinks and gum. He slept in bathroom stalls. And what made him, going to clubs, and he was young and hearing people sing, he's like, oh, what is that? And he heard opera. He wanted to become an opera singer. He got taken to the mountains by a gang. They beat him up and dug a grave, and they were going to leave him in a grave. He had no one. He had no mother, no father. And I can't even picture that. And it's like I try to show people this, and he even, like, he was saying how I'm friends with him on Facebook and how he felt sad. I'm like, no, you're beautiful. And I try to post, look, YouTube has over 100 million views. How is this person, you know, how is he not signed with all the pop that's out there? And it's like, isn't that the proof right there of over 100 million people have liked his videos on his going on that Korea Got Talent, he placed second. How is he not signed? And if you mention Korea, oh, my God, God forbid you mention something wonderful coming out of Korea. And it makes me mad. It really does. So I wrote to him. I says, I hope, you know, I'd like for you to do a song for my film, Funeral War. And I told him that. And I says, he's learning English. He's trying. He even videotaped himself learning English and going, he goes, I'm sorry, my English is not that good. And I says, that doesn't matter. I says, you're taking time out and you're learning my language so you can talk to me. That's a beautiful thing, and it doesn't bother me. So I'm just trying, and it seems like people do not care. And
well,
it's hard. It really is.
Well, I think everybody's got their own experiences. I mean, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe some people lost their family members in during the Korean War, or they've been bullied by a Korean person growing up. You know, unfortunately, you know, I think the thing is, you know, don't hate the culture, hate that person for doing what it was, instead of, you know, going, oh, I was bullied by this such and such, you know, guy from this country, and as a result, I hate everybody from that country. I mean, unfortunately, that's how people are, you know. I mean, and you can't change how people think.
Yeah, I know.
If you do, you're not going to end up following your own bliss. I mean, you gotta do your, you know, if you have a message with what you do, yeah, you know, it's only going to fall on deaf ears if they don't want to listen, you know.
Yeah, I know. I just try to show what I think is beautiful. And they say, you know, it's like trying to stay real. No?
That's all you can do. That's all you can do. That's, you know, and, yeah, you can't please everybody in this world. And if it is, you know, I don't know what it is. Yeah, if you can't please everybody in this world. That's the whole thing. You got to understand. You got to know what it is, why you're here, what you're doing, do it. You know, you're gonna have people that hate you work, and you have people that love your work. So, you know, you gotta be all right with that.
That's true, and being all right with everything. So I think I hope they're like literally gonna be in there. So I'm gonna pull them on. They've been waiting patiently in the queue. So are you ready for a caller?
Sure.
Okay, give me one second. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, is this Melissa?
Yes. It's a great conversation, you guys. I loved it. I loved all the really good information, especially about filmmaking. And so this is a question I have. You know, because I know, Shelley, you're making your film, and John's got a really good background in comedy and writing and, you know, working with Hong Kong guys and, you know, stunt coordinating and everything like that and you know, going to be directing films. So the question that I have is you know, you're talking about, like, certain films really, you know, get people and certain films don't and how we all have to do our research. What do you think makes a really good film? What elements need to be in a film so we do pay attention to the story? Because, Shelley, I know you're having issues with people not paying attention to, you know, the story you want to tell about this Korean gentleman. And so John, I was just wondering, what elements do you think make for a great film? Like, if Shelley's making her film or somebody's making their film out there, what elements do you think absolutely have to be in the film for people to say, hey, I want to go out and see that film?
Okay, there's got to be individualism and there's got to be universality. That's what I think. Okay, if you look at Joseph Campbell's archetype for the hero's journey, if you look at the archetype of all the points that need to happen for the character, for the audience to sympathize, no matter what country you're from, or what culture or what your religious beliefs are. I think he struck that perfect center. You know, if you look at the difference between episodes 4, 5, and 6 of Star Wars as opposed to 1, 2, and 3, you'll see it. You'll see the archetype in 4, 5, and 6 because Joseph Campbell was still alive and he helped, you know, Lucas with incorporating that into the story. Whereas, unfortunately, he passed away, you know, right after, not too long after that. And you didn't see any of that in episodes 1, 2, and 3. And for me, that's what I felt was kind of boring about it. You just didn't care. I think, you know, the hero's journey is really important as far as if you want to strike that chord as far as hitting that emotional base with your audience, as far as what they learn, what they, you know, how they come back to their normal world. And it's really important to understand that the elements in Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. I think some of the best films have that, like Working Girl had it, Romancing the Stone had it. Rocky had it. You know, all these stories have that, the hero's journey. They're struggling to come into themselves, and I think that's what you've got to do with your story. Thing is this: bastardized, and it can become formulaic. What you have to do is you got to make sure that it is there are key points in your story that you're telling, and you're not doing it because this has to happen. You know, Disney kind of did that with a lot of their animation films, and then Pixar came in and kind of, you know, sucker punched them. Like, what are they doing? What are they doing? We're not doing. It's like they're telling an engaging story, whereas all you care about is these bullet points, like it's a PowerPoint presentation. You know, that's my point of view when it comes to that stuff. You have to personalize each moment. If there's no reason for that scene to happen, don't write it. Each scene's got to turn. Each scene, each moment's got to be really engaged. If you're not engaged, delete it.
I guess you can relate that to fight scenes too. Sounds like. But I'm just, when I'm hearing you say that, it also sounds like a very similar to stand up. When we're doing stand up, it needs to be relatable and sympathetic and individual. Do you think that people need to do some background in stand-up or something like that? Do you think that's helpful for people that want to tell convincing stories? Or what do you think, some advice for people that want to do these stories?
Well, I guess a lot of writers are introverts, and they don't want to connect on that type of a level. But you know, there's always exceptions. I'm not saying that every writer has to be an introvert to be successful. I mean, it's kind of the quote unquote stereotype of what a writer is. But I think stand up helps with economy of words, how to engage an audience quickly and do that left turn. It teaches you that type of timing. If you could, that'd be great. I mean, you know, it's great for acting. It's great for writing. But it's not for everybody. I mean, it's rough. I mean, some of the experiences I went through stand-up, I would not wish my worst enemies on, you know, but it does teach you. I remember when I was at the Comedy Store, one of the patriarch of the place, his name is Argus Hambledon. He told me, he said, John, you know, whether you do this the rest of your life or not, you're going to walk away with a skill that you will never, that you can use, you know, for the rest of your life. And I didn't understand that until I left. And I was like, oh, God, okay, it helped me in everything that I've done. You know, how to talk to people, how to make somebody relax when they're all tense, you know, or how to pitch a story. You know, you gotta pitch it quick or else you're going to lose their attention.
I get that.
Yeah. Is there any other pointers that you could give Shelley in making her film?
Read a lot of screenplays. You know, take screenwriting classes. You got to have somebody kind of mentor you. It's really important to understand structure. Here's the thing. Absorb the rules, learn the rules, operate by the rules, and then discard the rules.
And then discard the rules? Is that what you said?
Yes. I mean, you gotta learn the rules, understand the rules, and then apply the rules, and then discard the rules. You know, that's what you do in martial arts. That's Bruce Lee's philosophy of JKD. It's any creative mindset if you want to be successful. Because if you don't discard the rules, you're just gonna be like everybody else. You got to know the rules. You got to know what the terrain is like. You got to know who's out there, who's doing this, who's doing that. That's learning the rules. Who's doing this? Why are they doing this?
Hmm.
And then once you understand those, once you understand your environment, you know who the players are. What are they doing? What are they doing that's making this successful? You know, even though you might not like their work, you got to look beyond what they're doing. You know, that you don't like, go, okay, I don't like this guy, this guy's work, but, you know, he's doing something that's getting people's attention. He's making these films that people are flocking to go. What is he doing? You know, is it PR? Is it what he's writing? Is it what he's, you know, what is it? You gotta understand what they're doing in order for you to move on. I mean, that's what I did with stand-up. I studied every comedian. I knew their strengths and their weaknesses, and you know whether I liked them or not. I knew what they did. You know, what was their selling point? What was their timing like? What are they doing? How are they manipulating the audience? It's the same thing with what I did when I was fighting, and what I do now with film and stunts. I do my best to know everybody that's in this business. You know, I was like, all right, this is what this guy's doing. Okay, this is where. Where are we going as far as this business is concerned? You know, you got to know who's out there. Because if you don't know who's out there, you don't know where we're going.
Hmm. Yeah. So would it be like, I don't know if this sounds crazy, because I'm more of an action chick, right? And it's like, I'm not really into, like, chick flicks, so now I tried, okay? This sounds silly because it's, like, coming from me, but I'm the worst crybaby when it comes to, like, watching films. I'm so loud. So I was like, okay, I'll just make sure I don't go to theater. I'll watch them at home. So I've been trying to watch actors and their emotions. Do you know, I don't know if you can understand if that's like the same thing, like trying to see how, you know, besides the action stuff, but to see how people really act hardcore. I don't know if that's a good example, learning how other people can act, but, you know, not just all with this the action stuff.
Well, you know, yeah, well, you're talking about programmers, action programmers. They're just like, there's a lot of action films, unfortunately, that are very, you know, there's no story to it. It's just, all right, let's just make them get to the action. And then that's not really good. That's not what I consider filmmaking, you know. I mean, there's got to be a reason for you to get into that fight. I mean, you there's got to be a build. It's got to be a setup. There's got to be a payoff. If you don't have that, and it's not strong, then, you know, it doesn't rock my boat, to be honest with you. I mean, it does for others. I mean, some people just want to go see action. I mean, I understand why they go. It's just they want to escape from their life, their daily routine, They just want to escape. They just want to see that guy that walks into that building and beat the crap out of people. No, I understand that. It's not that I don't. I do understand why they do that. But for me, I want you to walk away from the theater feeling like you met somebody new in your life. It's like, for me, one of my heroes is Kurosawa, Akira Kurosawa. He did Seven Samurai. I remember when I saw that movie as a kid, I walked away as if I met seven new friends. You know, you got into their world. You saw what they were like. And when they died or they survived, you were there along for that ride. And when they died, you died. A part of you died with them. You're like, no, that's a master storyteller, verbally and non-verbally. I mean, that's the only way. I mean, you know, you can do a martial arts film, you know, that has no soul, no spirit. So you'll be lucky if some people see it or not. You got to have some really off the hook action to make it work. But the thing is, you know, is that what you want to do? How you want to, you know, make your mark in this world?
So what, when you go to write, John, how do you get your ideas? I mean, you don't have to talk about a certain storyline. I mean, how do you start writing? Is it just something you just sit there, start writing? Do you think of something? I mean, what could you do if someone's has writer's block or to help out?
Well, I think what you get, my writing teacher told me to have more than one project on the fire. It's you're short order cook in a way. Because you might get writer's block on one story, but you might not have it on this other story. So, but the thing is, you got to be disciplined enough to finish those stories. Yeah, and also when you go for these meetings, you know, these execs will go, or these investors will go, well, I don't like that. I don't want to put money into that. What else you got? If you got just one story, then you're SOL.
Very true. Very true. Anyway, I'm going to jump off to more people.
What was that, Melissa?
I'm going to jump off so you can, I'm sure there's a lot more people that want to ask questions.
Okay, well, it's almost, what time is it right now? It goes by so fast. It's like quarter of the last hour. There's 15 minutes left. Did I not say time goes by fast? Melissa, thank you. I'm calling it.
Thanks, Shelley, for taking my call. I appreciate it, girl. Great conversation, a lot of learning. And thanks, John. Yeah, really a lot of learning, a lot of great stuff here. So this is so important because you always see a film and you're like, oh, God, I just didn't connect with that. And you always read scripts from people and you're trying to explain to them that, you know, no, this – people send you a script and you're like, no, this is not good. And so it's really important that people, you know, get what's relatable out there. So, you know, everybody's trying to make a great script. So, yeah, Shelley. So, go for it, girl. Keep writing. And thanks, John, for sharing all your good pieces of information, such a wealth of information. So any other advice, I'm sure I would love to hear it because it seems like it's real important to have that writing background and have, you know, that comedic background and the fighting background and, you know, and then also just being, you know, working with, sounds like doing the research is really important. So it sounds really good. So emotionally connecting with people and being able to emotionally bring out those thoughts and not being afraid to go places emotionally. So anyway, but thanks, guys. I better jump off so Shelley can bring up more people. All right, thanks, guys.
Have a good Sunday.
Yeah, thanks. Bye.
Bye. We got a little bit of time left. Is there anything else that you'd want to talk about, any new projects coming up, like off your IMDb page? I don't know what else you can speak about because I know, confidentiality. I mean, anything else you can speak about?
Well, Dragon Fest is coming out on May 19th. It's in Burbank. You know, all the proceeds have benefit the Martial Arts History Museum. I don't know if you've been to Dragon Fest, but it used a while back, it was like a martial arts convention, and it was so much fun because every martial artist was, every martial artist that was a martial artist was there signing autographs, talking with you. It was like a day-long, love fest of martial arts, and it was great. I mean, it was a lot of fun. Every year, everybody looked forward to it. I mean, there were people would come from all over the world and sleep in line just for that one day. I mean, I remember one guy came from Germany, and this is what's happening. It's kind of like what's happening now with this. And we're doing this on May 19th. I think it's May. Go to the Martial Arts History Museum website to get the info, and there are tickets on there. Melissa and I will be there. We'll be, my book will be there. We're going to be selling a DVD of this seminar that we taught. It's Fight Design for Filmmakers. I teach the three-act structure of a fight scene, and Melissa talks about safety and insurance and all the other important things of what a filmmaker needs to know to do action for their films. And, that's what I'm kind of working on. I just finished Jade Trader with Melissa. She was a second-year director, and Jerry Pillay was the director on it, and I fought Tree Carradine on it. So that was a lot of fun.
Wow.
But as far as, let me add one more thing to the advice, is you got to know what's good and bad. You got to know the difference between good and bad. I know that's kind of black and white about it, but you have to develop a sense, a taste. Like, for example, when I was doing stand-up and I was going to take writing classes, I had the freedom of going to a video store and renting two videos. I would rent a good one and a bad one. And it wasn't just a good film and bad film. I would get the same genre of film. Like one day I got Free Jack and Blade Runner, and I watched them back to back. And I was like, oh, okay, you saw how the characters talked, how they acted, how things were set up, and you kind of develop a sense for that. You have to develop that sense in order to write about it.
So, I get what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, watch, then rent, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and a Bruce Lee impersonator movie. Good and bad. Just compare it back to back. Don't just sit there and compare it. Just feel it. Do you feel an emotion? Yeah. How are they eliciting an emotion? Are they doing it real? Are they doing it, artfully? Or are they doing it really cheesily? That's how you develop a sense. You have to consciously be aware of it, because this is what you're going to be writing.
I get what you mean. It's to study as much as I can, even before I write the script.
Yeah, I would also take screenwriting classes. Around the area, whatever you have. I mean, there's a lot of books to read, like Sid Mead's book. There's a lot of books to read on screenwriting, and everybody's got their opinion on it. So that's the other thing. For me, it was really important that I took classes at UCLA Extension, because there was always somebody there to kind of fill in the blanks that a book couldn't do. I'm not type of a guy. I'm not Quentin Tarantino, where I just look a bunch of scripts and then I write Reservoir Dogs. I'm not that gifted. I have to be mentored. That's just me. I just know that I had to be that way in order to learn, because that's the way I've always been. It was with martial arts, and with art and all this stuff. I have to have somebody kind of show me the way in the beginning in order to know where I'm going. So once I understand it, I'll kind of do what I need to do. So that it's important to ask for help, get somebody that can teach it to you. I mean, I go to wherever classes you can. And even if it's not writing, screenwriting in particular, I mean, if it's creative writing, you gotta kind of get into that.
Yeah, that sounds Wow, my head's spinning. Just thinking about it, I'm like, wow. And I've got such a long way to go on this. On this one film,
oh,
I was
long
like,
here's the thing. You're always going to be learning. If you're not learning, then there's something wrong. I mean, Kurosawa, when he received his honorary Oscar, he said his words, I mean, after he's done all these legendary movies, he said, I don't feel like I deserve this. I got this too soon because there's still a lot for me to learn about filmmaking. And you're like, wow, okay, that tells you where this guy's head's at. He's always learning, and it's true. Technology, you know, the cameras, there's all these new cameras and all these new technology coming in that you're always learning. And there's also, I mean, there's so many artists out there doing different things and changing how we see things. So you're always evolving. You always have to have that white belt mind. If you don't have that white belt mind where if you're like, you know, I know everything, then, you know, you really don't need to be in this business.
I guess that's a good way to, like, you know, tell me white belt mind, because I get that. Because I am. I'm always like, oh, man. And it's like I get so much overload at once and I have to take a step back. It's like, man, you know a hell of a lot more than me. That's for sure. I'm like, oh, boy. It's so much intake.
You got to start somewhere. And you just got to enjoy the journey. If you're not enjoying it, you're not gonna succeed.
Well, John, thank you so much. I mean, anything else? Any shout outs to anyone? Say hi or anything before I let you go? Or
trying to think. I think I said what I needed to say. But yeah, you know, just follow your bliss. I mean, read Joseph Campbell's quote about following your bliss, because that's helped me through a lot of things in my life. You know, you gotta make that commitment. You gotta do what you love, because if you don't, then whose life are you living, really?
That stuck with me, and that's like, I think it was over a year ago you were actually on my show, or a year and a half or something like that, and I haven't forgotten. Ever since you said follow your bliss, I've never forgotten that. It stuck with me.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so you got to surround yourself with people that are doing something, you know, and that rubs off on you. Yeah, they're doing something positive that are movers, and, you know, that rubs off on you.
Yeah. Well, thank you, John. I get exactly, you know, a lot of stuff that you're saying. You broke down a lot of stuff that I could understand, and I hope you're on my show again. You know, I would definitely be honored if you're on my show again sometime.
Sure, anytime. Let me know when.
Okay. Well, thank you, and keep in touch. And like I said, if there's anything, let me know, post on my wall, send me a message or something like that. Keep in touch, and I'd be glad to talk about it on my Facebook page or do a promo. Even if you're too busy, I'll bring it up on my show anytime.
All right. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you, and enjoy the rest of your week.
All right. You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. My show goes by so fast. Ninja Sunday, didn't I tell you? Ninja Sunday's awesome. And I'm so thankful Johnny Crang once again on my show. I'm so blessed. I just feel so excited and so pumped. I can't tell that I'm so excited, so pumped. Anytime I got, like, Ninja Peeps on my show, I'm pumped. Well, anyway, you know, just like I always say, if you have a dream out there, and like Johnny said, you know, follow your bliss. And just remember, you're as good as anybody else. So it's one step at a time, and looking forward to, you know, next show. Some people from the martial arts, there's another one, Martial Arts Kid, a couple people from that film that's starring Donna Dragon Wilson and Cynthia Rothrock, and I will be having a couple of people on my show, Ewat Chin, and I hope I said his name right. Forgive me for that. If I didn't, I do talk kind of funny, but he's one of the people, one of the producers from the show, and also James Wilson, Don the Dragon Wilson's brother. James Wilson, those two will be on my show on Wednesday night. So once again, everybody, thank you for the love and the support and the continuation of supporting my show. Thank you so much, and I'm going to leave you all with a song from a recent guest on my show, Cardiac. And this is one of his songs, Let Me Know. So everyone enjoy it. And for this feel-good song, thank you once again, and have a good day.
I've been waiting, girl.